Welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast from ExchangeWire, bringing you the latest news and views from the world of ad tech, media, and marketing.
Hello, and welcome to this week's Mad Tech Podcast. I'm excited about this week. It is a very special mailbag edition where we have three questions from our audience that I'm going to put to two of our senior team. Welcoming CEO Rachel Smith.
Thank you very much, John. Delighted to be on the Mailbag Special.
I know. I'm pleased to have your insights for these beautiful listener questions. Welcoming also Lindsay Rowntree, COO.
Hello. Lovely to be here.
Good. Are you ready to answer some mailbag questions?
I definitely am.
Amazing. Well, we've got a really good selection across the ad tech industry. I'm going to kick us off with a question that has come in from Barney Wolfolk-Smith of David. He has asked, so Adobe expects Gen A content to grow by about five times, but 70% of Gen A ads already generate below average positive emotions and are 13% less trusted than the norm from our research at David. Is the industry sleepwalking into a creative quality crisis? Oh, crikey, I've mangled that.
Well, it's pretty hard to say.
Creative quality. Is the industry sleepwalking into a creative quality crisis, and who's responsible for catching it? Thank you for that alliteration, Barney. Rachel, what do you reckon? How is AI impacting creativity? Who's responsible for it?
So I think that I want to start by sharing with you a little anecdote from a friend of mine in Sydney who is a computer animator, because he and I got into a conversation in January about the role that AI was playing in the creative process in his work. So he works for, he's worked in film studios and TV production studios doing computer animation, advertising agencies, and now he works for a special effects company that does special effects for all of those sorts of industries. So his primary role is inserting pieces of creative video content in particular parts within some kind of video. And so we got into a conversation about the role that AI was playing in his day-to-day job, and he said that they were actively using AI tools, including him, to create portions of videos that then get overlaid with special effects, sometimes animated via computer, obviously, and then teaching AI models how to then perform those tasks without a human performing them. And he said that it was both exciting and terrifying because he was delighted with the amount of time that was giving him back and the amount of time that he would ordinarily pour into going over someone else's work was now being significantly reduced. And he also wasn't having to hire and pay designers to necessarily complete all of those tasks. The other thing he said was, this was early days experimenting with some AI tools that are available on the market at the time. The other thing he said was that they were extremely good quality. So that was the part that was terrifying. He was thinking, not only am I now no longer employing a designer to do this task, I'm really impressed with the output. But then we got into a conversation about how we even get to that output. And I was insistent that the only reason, well, not the only reason, one of the main reasons why the output was so good is because he was prompting the AI tool to refine, he was giving it the initial brief, he was getting whatever, and he kept saying that whatever he was getting back in the initial stages was really good quality. So that's because you were giving it an extensive brief, because you're an expert and because you know what you're looking for. So my feeling was one of, a mixture of these AI tools that we're all coming across in our day-to-day lives for sure are going to enhance many things about the way that we work, and producing creative assets I don't think is any different. But that actually the real skill will be in some form of human interaction or human instruction to make it truly distinctive and different, non-generic, and something that stands out of the crowd. And when I was thinking about my mate Jezza's example, that's precisely what he's paid for.
My mate Jezza. Obviously, Australian has to have a can't have a full name. No.
He does actually have a normal name, but nobody uses it.
Of course not.
So, but he, that is actually what he's paid for, is to sprinkle that kind of human magic over what was already a digital industry, right? So, you know, and even when he graduated at university, he did like an industrial design degree and went straight into computer animation. And computer animation at the time was talked about as this thing that was overtaking manual animation and really changing the way that, you know, films were made and constructed. Like, he worked on the original Happy Feet film, things like that, that were of their time, completely different to anything we'd seen before. So there's a part of me in all of this, in Barney's question, that thinks there is every reason to believe that this can be an enhancement on creative production rather than just sleepwalking into generic nonsense. But it is going to require human intervention to make sure that the sleepwalking scenario doesn't happen. And if we think about this and its use and application in an advertising context, yet again, you know, Jez is like trying to make great, cool videos for film and television and sometimes advertising, but Barney works for an ad tech platform that's trying to improve the quality of advertising, and that's sort of our day-to-day business. There's no reason why we can't be using those AI tools to improve quality rather than to reduce originality and to create something generic. But we have to really be switched on. We have to have our eyes open. Otherwise, you know, we might end up in the sleepwalking scenario. The thing that the bit that makes me hopeful is that our entire industry has been moving away from, if you like, a generic, uninteresting form of advertising that was, you know, until this moment fueled by cookie-based targeting, to something that has to be, by design, much more personalised, because it needs to be opted into, it needs to adhere to privacy constraints. And so therefore the entire industry, I think, is actually, you know, by design or by accident, moving towards a more intentional form of advertising. So I'd like to think that inherent in Barney's question is what's going to happen to the quality of advertising. I like to think that there's some natural pressures in the industry at the moment that will drive us more towards quality and away from generic nonsense, because generic nonsense isn't going to work. It's not going to produce the results that brands and advertisers and marketers are looking for.
Lindsay.
Yeah, I mean, I love the anecdote because I totally agree. I think that when you remove the barriers to entry and kind of democratise something, the barriers are normally cost. And with cost comes regulation, oversight, everything else. If you make everybody be able to access something, you're removing the aspect that kind of makes it then, you remove the checks and balances. And that's what we now exist in a world where barriers to entry have been completely removed. And so within that, checks and balances have been completely removed. And we need to find a way of bringing that back in. And often cost is the thing that does that. So if you remove the cost limitations, and I don't mean, obviously, like, AI is expensive and using credits is expensive, but how expensive is that versus a full, like, 30-second TV spot shoot?
Yeah.
That requires a full studio, it requires runners, it requires production staff, it requires that, whatever it requires, like, that versus how many credits you need to create an ad on AI, and no matter how many people you've got, like, what was it? It was the Coca-Cola ad from last year where Coca-Cola were trying to come out and say, yeah, but we had a huge team, like, there's so many people involved in making this. It's like, yeah, but it's still AI and it still kind of freaks us out. And, you know, David's own research and I've seen Kantar research as well that sort of backs this up, that people aren't necessarily against AI ads. Like, AI ads will neither break your campaign or kind of make your campaign. It's somewhere in the middle. The only reason it will break it is if it's shit. Mm. And that's the problem, I think, is there's so many shit AI ads. Mm. And it's the human touch and it's the human oversight that I think was going to cause a campaign to be successful or not. And like, and again, a lot of these different researchers, and I think Dave was part of that as well, was that AI ads will generally elicit an emotion, but it isn't necessarily a good emotion. Mm. It can make them angry. And I think Kantar did an A-B test in Europe with two Coca-Cola Christmas ads. One was an animal-based one. I don't know if you guys saw it, but it was like a rabbit and whatever, like frolicking in a wintry forest. And the other was the famous one that involves people. And everyone preferred the animal one to the people one. Mm. And it's that uncanniness around having people in ads that still freaks people out. Like, because you're looking at it, you're going, something isn't right about this, but I don't know what. Yeah. And I keep seeing eToro ads on TV, on streaming platforms, eToro, the kind of the investment platform. And there's some weird kind of, like, he looks sort of Swiss with like shoulder length blonde hair. They've made him look a bit like a kind of, you know, kind of unassuming you know, Northern European man. And he's AI, and it drives me mad because he's clearly AI, and it really annoys me. I think part of it is I wish they would disclose that it's AI.
Yeah.
If they just said this is AI generated ad at the bottom, I'd be like, okay, fine, but don't make me have to guess. Mm. Don't make me have to try and work out if it is. Like on Instagram and on the social media platforms, you see these kind of like either this kind of Amish elder or this kind of Chinese auntie, or you know, these people kind of saying, if you see a pepper that's this or this is a male pepper. It's all absolute bollocks, but it's and you're looking at it going, are you a real person? I really feel like you're not a real person. You're trying to find text around them to see if the text is mangled or their teeth, because their teeth keep moving. And you have to look at all these things, and we shouldn't, and as consumers, we shouldn't have to be doing that sort of stuff. So either you declare it or you don't declare it. And if you are going to kind of go down the AI route because it saves you money, you need to spend the money on the checks and balances and the human oversight. In a world where regulation hasn't caught up with how fast AI is developing, I think that's what we need in the meantime. We need to kind of like be human about it and be normal about it and be like, well, okay, if an AI ad is kind of okay, but people want to be able to know it's AI and people don't like humans in AI, don't use them. Mm. And there's an Instagram, someone I follow on Instagram, I think it's called Sergio Chili. He's a director. He directs ads and things, but it's satirical. He does these videos where he kind of goes actors versus AI. So he'll give them a prompt, like he would prompt an actor in an ad and ask them to kind of like just say this. And it's always an absolute car crash. And in one of them, he's like, right, say this. And the bloke pulls out a gun and he's like, is that a fucking gun? And it's like, yeah. And it's really funny. But the point he's trying to make is like, we do still need people in this in this world.
Yeah.
And actually at the moment, for the most part, humans will not be replaced by AI, but AI is definitely becoming a real thing when it comes to advertising. So how do we make it work? And there are lots of studies being done. Like I think it was 2024, Kantar did a study where it was I think it's they do an annual media effective media attitudes to media attitudes to media. And so this is a couple of years old, but I imagine it's not changed. The percentage of people, the percentage of consumers that liked AI ads versus the percentage of people that run marketing campaigns that liked them, was there was a disparity. The people that are running the campaigns should be looking,
they're not
at
the intended audience.
No, exactly.
So
you like it because it's easy for you to do your job and you think it's the future. But actually, if your consumers don't like it, you need to have a rethink here as to what's going to work. And I think that we can certainly make AI effective. And there's already proof that AI ads are effective, but we need the human touch.
And I guess the fear...
I think I said the same thing about 10 times over there in various guises, but you know what I'm getting at.
But it was entertaining journey, though, I think,
Lindsay. Thank you very much. Thank you. I think
probably the fear, listening to what you were saying, Lindsay, I think the fear is, and I completely understand where this comes from because I do think this is a real concern, that we'll sort of morph to, if we accept that there's already some pretty average AI ads out there, and there's some ads that you talked about that were, you know, that people were surveyed on their responses and attitudes towards them in studies. So there are some AI ads where with people in them that people don't really like because it's too obvious that those are not real people. They prefer the animal stuff. But if we accept that those ads already exist, I guess the fear is, at what point do we stop recognizing that the poor quality ads with fake AI people that, you know, kind of are a bit jarring for us? At what point do we stop thinking that that's rubbish, and do we just sort of accept that you know, it is rubbish, but it's just there and it's everywhere and it's all around us, so you just try to ignore it? And the sort of analogy I draw is I won't use reality TV because that's very controversial, but maybe something like I'm going to go out on a limb here and think about things like plastic surgery and injectables, right? Probably 20 years ago, people walking around with lots of injectables in their face, no matter how natural looking they are, was really shocking. It's not anymore. It's only shocking when it's really bad work. It's only shocking when, you know, because it's just become an accepted norm. And I think that's what the fear is, right? That how long before we stop recognizing the poor quality stuff as poor quality. We maybe just, it's not that we suddenly think it's good quality, but we just sort of accept that it exists. Because if we do that, perhaps it just takes over the majority of advertising inventory. And before you know it, we've got rubbish quality everywhere.
But you're right. Actually, it's a good point because the fillers and Botox argument, there's a massive online conversation at the moment around it was hyped up with the Devil Wears Prada 2 coming out,
yep,
and doing side-by-side comparisons of the same actors versus them 20 years ago, where they look completely unchanged and they have not aged at all in those prevailing 20 years. And everyone was saying, has the emotion been filled out of acting? Because it used to be that filler people, I think it's Amelia Clarke who says, I don't use Botox before any acting gigs because I need the emotion in my face.
Yeah.
But there's so much work being done to people's faces now that you can't tell if there's no emotion being brought there.
Yeah.
I think Lindsay Lohan was using an example because she looks absolutely incredible, but versus what she looked like 20 years ago. But I think that is a really good point because actually maybe that makes AI's argument easier, because if there's no emotion left in anyone's faces anymore, it's easier for AI to replicate it, surely.
True.
Well, that's about the most dystopian thing I've heard on this podcast, yeah, and we've been doing this a while, Lindsay.
I do like to bring the dystopian element to the conversation.
You really do. The second part to Barney's question was, who's responsible for catching this? I think we've answered that quite comprehensively, that it's us. It's humans.
Well, yeah, at the moment, I think it is us.
It is. And that's what I mean when I say I'm kind of hoping that the test of this will be in the results of advertising campaigns, right? And if they don't work, because if you think about what ads you actually respond to and what video ads, well, let's even say TV ads that you respond to, it's stuff that's got really good quality creative in it. And if it doesn't have really good quality creative, you don't notice it, you don't remember it, you certainly don't interact with it. I know there's a whole other layer, you know, a subversive layer of advertising that's about brand recognition and all of those things. But ultimately, we remember the ads in our lives that were of exceptional creative quality. That's still got to be the standard, surely, because that's the stuff that moves the bottom line for brands and marketers. But I think that also gets us into another conundrum, which is, what is it exactly that we're measuring? And that's probably, you know, the sort of the crux of where we're at in the advertising industry, which is, and we talk about it almost every day, our measurement standards that we invented at the beginning of digital aren't really keeping pace with actually what we need to demand from investment into advertising these days, because actually the stakes are so much higher. It's either privacy concerns or it's the quality of the creative. So, you know, we need to be measuring different things. And those things that we should be measuring is, are these ads shifting more units? Are brands and marketers selling more stuff? Not just I'm a publisher or a content provider and I've sold the inventory. It is, has this actually made a difference for brands and marketers and their businesses? And I would argue it's only good quality advertising that really does that. I'm sure lots of people would disagree, but, you know, that's...
Well, I don't know if they... who would disagree, though? Because ultimately, as you say...
Performance marketers, maybe.
Yeah, but it's that, you know, money... it's down to... What? I don't know what I'm trying to say. I was going to say money talks. That's not what I'm trying to say at all. But it's down to the bottom line. And as you just said it, like if the money isn't coming in, if the revenue isn't coming in, then they have to revisit kind of what is causing that. And, well, let's have a look at our completely AI-generated ads and see if that's causing the problem. But every single bit of the campaign will get scrutinised.
Yeah.
And the creative is the first thing everyone goes to.
Another one of those things.
Exactly.
But I also wonder if, you know, a bit similar to my example about, you know, Botox and fillers, I also wonder if the advertising industry still thinks that there is a high enough tolerance in the general public for crappy ads. Because let's think about the early days of desktop advertising and those ridiculous shoe adverts that just appeared across the top of your screen and chased you around for months, even after you'd purchased. So, you know, there'll be plenty of people that have never even been exposed to that kind of advertising. But I think there is this thought, particularly from a performance angle, that will tolerate quite a lot of pretty average quality advertising. And I guess that's where other technology tools and platforms come in, which is, not only do you not have to have shitty advertising, you can actually use tools to create better quality advertising. But in the long run, it'll be better for your brand.
And who's your target market as well? Because a lot of these studies look at Gen Z and Gen Z's reaction to AI ads. You could imagine your older person. So my dad, for example, in his 70s, he might look at AI and he would have a fucking clue that it's AI, and he would think it's completely legitimate. And so he wouldn't have any emotion over it because to him it's normal. And so again, like where and how you use AI will come into play depending on what your target audience is. I also want to verify the completely made up numbers I gave earlier. I've looked them up. The Kantar is Kantar's Media Reactions 2024. And it's the other way around to what I said. So 41% of consumers say AI-generated ads bother them, whereas 29% of marketers say the same thing. So it's not like AI ads. It's actually get disturbed by AI ads, and 41% of actual consumers don't like them, whereas fewer marketers don't like them.
Yeah,
and so they need to kind of come up to the same level of, well, of consumers. But again, it's still not a majority.
No.
A minority of well, it might be a majority depending on what the questions were. But if it's a simple yes or no, then the majority are fine by them. And as you know, David's own research points out, like, it's not going to make or break a campaign.
Mm.
It's how you use it. And your anecdote, my mate Jezza, kind of is perfect for that. It's exactly like, we need the human touch to it. And also we need to recognise that we have to be the ones putting that work in, because there's nobody else going to be doing it. It's down to us. It's down to, like, okay, if AI is going to really kind of work and help our business from a creative perspective, then and from a performance perspective, we need to actually look at, we scrutinise it heavily and see if it's working for us or not.
Yeah. The ad industry seems to have decided, in terms of demographics, that my guy is Peter Crouch. He is following me around everywhere. Every advert for a podcast.
AI Peter Crouch?
No, just Peter Crouch.
Oh.
Like, you know, yeah. No disrespect to Crouchy. Great footballer, great. I'm sure he's a great guy, but the company seemed to have decided, 41-year-old man, must love Crouchy. He's on, he's got a travel podcast with Abby Clancy. He's on the betting adverts on my sports channels. So yeah, maybe they'll AI Crouchy at some
they
point.
They might but
that's
too.
Just made me laugh recently.
AI Crouchy.
I can. I really can. right. Thank you very much, Barney, for that question. Friend of Exchange Wire forever. I'm going to move us on to question two from KSA Lamore. Speaking of friends of Exchange Wire,
KSA, absolutely.
We've had her on many times, and she's wonderful. So I'll get to her question. If retail media is truly the third big wave of digital advertising, why are we still building it on first wave infrastructure, incentives and measurement? Ooh, Lindsay, how do you feel?
It's quite a sad question, isn't it? Because, I mean, she's not wrong, really.
No. Good question.
The point is, everything's being built on, like, first wave infrastructure, and that is largely the problem. And I suppose retail media is getting scrutinised more because it is a newer channel. And, you know, as a newer channel, you should, if you're a new channel, everything should be able to be done with it. You should be able to track every single thing. This is brand new. I'm investing my money into it. I should be able to see every single little thing that's going on, understand attribution completely and perfectly. Well, no, because the technology that it's built upon doesn't exist yet. And that is the case with any new channel or any technology that comes in on legacy channels even. If you look at kind of out of home and if you look at audio, it's a similar kind of problem, I think, that the legacy, we're building on legacy infrastructure, we're using legacy measurement tools, legacy attribution tools, and retail media is a victim of that. And one of the biggest problems I think that retail media is coming under is probably to go back to obviously another conversation about AI, it's probably the main channel that exists that's going to be probably kind of sort of in some form or another be completely subsumed by agentic. The reason being that when it comes to retail media, if most of our transactions kind of end up happening through agentic platforms and we don't actually interact with it, we don't do any of the transaction ourselves, it's all done via agents. You know, we had KSA's colleague, Gemma Spencer, a while ago, doing a coffee with me, and we talked about this quite in depth. Like, what does agentic retail media look like? Who am I? If I'm an advertiser, who am I advertising to? Am I advertising to the bot or to the agentic platform, or am I advertising to a human? And that's a big something we've got to wrestle with and reconcile, understanding kind of what that looks like. I think that the problem retail media is going to have is because it's going through that journey of, like, some of it's going to be agentic targeting, some of it's going to be human, like consumer targeting. It's going to really have a bit of an identity crisis, I feel like, and the technology it's built on is not going to help that matter. And you've got people in, you know, retail media is a huge investment channel. There's been so much growth in it. It's fascinating to look at how much growth we've seen across the world in the different formats that exist in retail media. And you've obviously got not just with endemic brands, but non-endemic brands getting into it as well. I find that fascinating. It's such an interesting space to watch. But it does feel like it's sort of tailing off a bit because, like, the innovation can't happen, A, because of the infrastructure, and B, innovation is not being stalled as such, but the conversation's being stalled because there's this kind of unknown when it comes to the role that agentic will play in retail media going forwards and commerce media going forwards. So I feel that that's going to cause a lot of questions to happen. And VML, I know, are doing some amazing stuff in this space, some really interesting stuff, and working with some really interesting with big clients on things. So they will. They are almost, you could argue, sort of leaders in the space when it comes to kind of from the buying side of things. But if, you know, if even they're asking the question, it tells you that there's a lot of work to be done. And the infrastructure is necessarily going to change until... It's a bit like, we talked about this a few weeks ago with Omnicom's bet on agentic versus, you know, what the likes of Index have done with containerization and Bedrock containerization. And it's like, what do you... You need to get the base infrastructure ready before you try and build agentic on top of everything. And retail media suffers here because everyone's trying to build agentic on top of it, but the infrastructure is not good enough to maybe do that. And I worry about what that's going to look like in the next couple of years if the infrastructure remains kind of subpar and everyone's trying to kind of look at what the next wave of retail media is, because it's the newest channel. It feels like it should evolve the quickest. But it can't, because the infrastructure isn't really there. And I do wonder kind of what that's going to look like.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is definitely an issue of retail media being built on top of existing ad tech infrastructure or legacy ad tech infrastructure. So it's sort of mirrored how we built ad tech for display advertising and search. And I think some people would also argue, I know Ciaran has said this, you know, certainly rowing back sort of 18 months, 2 years, when retail media was really in a very explosive sort of state, that actually isn't retail media just sort of a slightly fancier version of search advertising in an environment where there's maybe a little bit more intent. And he wasn't wrong, because at the time, especially if you looked at retail media network owners, they were often retailers who were doing exactly that. They're like, oh, wait, we've got all this shopper data and we've got all this intent, so let's just find a way to monetize it and match those things together. And their main aim is to sell their inventory, right? On top of being a retail media, you know, on top of potentially being a retailer, it's also to run their retail media network, right? Yeah. Actually, the main aim for brands and marketers is to shift the bottom line. And so that's, I think, where we're starting to see the disparity. I think to start with, for lots of brands and marketers, it was worthwhile putting more investment into retail media because other channels were creaking, namely display. If we think about all of the cookie shenanigans that went on for a good, you know, that sort of a bit like COVID kind of erased a couple of years of our lives in ad tech, didn't it? All for nothing. During that time, it was quite attractive to most, you know, intelligent marketers to think about shifting their budgets somewhere else where they could actually see some results. Retail media was the perfect channel at the time, right? They understood the technology tools and you know, broadly how the transaction was going to unfold, but it was a more intent-laden environment. That worked to a point, but there is finite inventory available within owned and operated retail media networks. And so then what do you do after that? You need to expand your horizons, and that's where we start to see the broader connection between retail media and commerce media. And that's, I think, where you're starting to see, I imagined, agencies working with their brand clients are probably asking questions like, well, how can I replicate these sorts of transactions, but outside this particular retail media network? You know, how can I do this more broadly? And I think that's a commerce media play.
Yeah.
And I think that requires more sophisticated, updated infrastructure. And that's where the rub is. So, you know, Kese's question is a good one because she's spot on. We're still running mostly retail media networks using first wave infrastructure. We haven't reached third wave infrastructure yet, but we're starting to see those new technology tools and innovations creep into retail media networks and other parts of the advertising market, you know, other channels, to try to either replicate what you can get in a retail media environment, which is more intent and better data, or to try to improve that retail media network environment and expand it out to a commerce media play. But it's a really fragmented landscape, right? There's the retailers that own and operated retail media networks. They're not going to welcome lots of new technology, depending on what their tech setup's like, you know, whether they've white labeled it or whether they've purchased something or partnered with somebody. They're not just going to open their doors to every other tech tool that comes along, and they want to be very, protective of their data. So that's why you're starting to see, you know, we looked at Kevil working with Nexta. Thank you. Yes, who they bought.
Yes.
It's just that all the ad tech companies got the same names. And so after a while, you're like, was it Nexta or was it Nexted? Or was it, you know, something else? Nexon, that's it. So, you know, Kevil's acquisition of Nexta was exactly that, trying to expand out that retail media concept and that retail media environment to a wider commerce media sort of opportunity. So I completely agree with you, Lindsay. It is an infrastructure issue and an infrastructure problem. And my take on Kiese's question is, you know, the why are we still operating in that environment? Well, there is a bit of a contradiction there in terms of, desired outcomes between retail media network owners and between what brands and agencies want. That's number one. They don't necessarily want the same thing. They're not looking for the same thing. And number two is it's a complex technology landscape, and it's not as easy as going, oh, okay, this infrastructure doesn't suit our wider, desires. So let's just add a few extra things on, or let's go into another network environment and see what we can get. It's a case of kind of mixing things up and seeing what works best per client, which is probably where Kiese's frustration comes in, because she's working for an agency with very progressive brands who want more sophistication. And I think what I'd say is that's coming, but we need to start thinking about things a bit differently. And for, because brands want an omni-channel approach. So they don't want to just be locked into walled garden after walled garden after walled garden. So that's where the retail media industry, I think, has got a bit of a reckoning coming its way. You know, they need to think about how they can either open up their networks to enable brands to bring in more data or other technology solutions to help activate that data, or they need to start thinking with a commerce media mindset.
Yeah, I agree. I think something you sent, John, was a quote in it from somebody in the US, a tech exec in the US, who said that in the world of agentic and in retail media, only Amazon wins. And I think that that's a shame and maybe a bit reductive to look at things that way. But we do probably, and everything you said, Rachel, I think highlights we do probably have a bit of an ownership problem. Mm-hmm. And as we tend to do in the ad tech industry, there is an ownership problem because no one owns retail media. No one, gone are the days where, you'd have Bock and kind of AppNexus kind of building something, and then that they take ownership of the ad server. They take ownership of the SSP, and then everything is kind of built from that one thing. There aren't as many standards in retail media yet. I think IAB, what have I got here? IAB Europe have released the Commerce Media Measurement Standards V2 with Tesco Media, which will set a default 30-day look-back window, and it's underpinned by a retail media certification program, which lets retailers demonstrate audited compliance with a transition window to end of July 2026. That is something, and that's going to make a difference when it comes to the measurement and attribution side of things. And it's a starting point, but it's still, compared to kind of how big retail media is and the direction it's going, there's going to be a lot more required, and people are going to need to feel they can turn to someone. And I think, obviously IABs tend to sort of set their stall out with these things. I think they're going to be the people that are going to have to help the industry out here when it comes to standardization and when it comes to regulation and understanding measurement. Because as you say, Rachel, it's all outcomes led. It's all bottom line led. If I can't measure that, then I'm not going to invest in it. I'm just not going to.
Exactly. At some point, that is what's going to happen, right? And because I didn't even touch on that AI and the agentic side of what you were talking about, Lindsay, that every time I go back to that mentally, I just think about how people discover products and information in an AI search world. What it means is that all brands and publishers and content creators need to have a brand and understand how they show up and are visible in an AI search environment. And that completely changes the landscape. And so, Lindsay, you very articulately gave us a sketch of what that looks like from a tech perspective, which is effectively at the moment still a bit of a mess because people are trying to build on top of existing ad tech infrastructure. But it's even more urgent for retail media network owners, especially if they're owned and operated retailers, and any brand out there, and also any publisher out there, because you need to know and understand how you're visible in that environment before you can even be thinking about how you offer brands and marketers some kinds of value for advertising within any kind of environment that you've set up. So it's far more complex now when you think about AI replacing our search habits. So
it does feel like the agentic AI onslaught really did pull the rug under what we thought retail media was going to become.
This is it. Yeah, exactly.
Totally. And I go back to, what I said at the start of this, which is Kieron used to talk about it all the time in the early days of retail media. Oh, it's just slightly more sophisticated search advertising. Well, we're in a new world. Search doesn't exist anymore. So we're going to have to think about it again from a completely different perspective. And that's why, again, retail media network owners need to get more commerce media focused in their outlook.
Yeah.
I think.
Great. Excellent. Right. Thank you very much, Kiese, for that question. I'll move us on to our final question of the mailbag from Kamal Ed Hadef from Audion. So his question is, AI agents are enabling audio advertising to evolve rapidly. Brands increasingly use it to drive tangible outcomes as well as build brand awareness. But are marketers ready to adopt audio as a full funnel channel? I love audio. Lindsay, what do you reckon?
I also love audio. Audio, I think, is an underrepresented channel.
Agreed.
And it's not talked about enough. And it feels like it's often talked about in the audio echo chamber. And there's not enough conversation outside of that echo chamber about how great audio can be. Mm. One of the biggest problems with audio is and still is measurement. And I think that that is where it falls down as a full funnel channel. And, you know, we listen to us, we're recording a podcast. We obviously, we have an understanding of audio measurement ourselves and in terms of, you know, what we can see, what we can't see. Like, audio measurement is limited and it requires a lot of understanding. There's very little last click attribution abilities with audio. You're still having to kind of understand it with the context of other channels and use it with mixed marketing, MMM, attribution models. Like that's where it really kind of shows its value. As a standalone channel, it's much more challenging to be able to see that. And there's definitely improvements, definitely things are being done. And you know, obviously, Kamel's question around kind of is agentic, is audio, oh my God, I need to go and have a lie down. What role is AI playing in improving this? Like it's obviously playing an absolutely huge role and it will continue to, but it's still, I don't think it's not necessarily ready in terms of, from a marketer perspective, will a marketer want to break out audio and go, do you know what? I feel like I know what I'm doing here. I'm going to put everything in audio. I think as a performance channel, I don't think they're ready to do that yet because you just can't see it. I think as a brand awareness channel, I think brands are all in. But when you're trying to look at it before, and you could argue that everything is now performance branding or branding performance. And that is very, very true. And obviously from an outcome perspective, audio plays really well alongside other channels. But as a standalone performance, lastly attribution channel, I don't think it's there yet. Or certainly marketers don't see it to be there yet. And marketers are reticent for that because they need to see that information. You know, tied in with everything else we talked about this episode. It's the measurement piece is what's often lacking and it's so important. And there's a kind of there's a walled garden issue here within the audio space that it is difficult to get data out of those walled gardens. So you are having to use different tools to try and pull that together and different platforms report on different things. They'll report on listens, they'll report on engagement. And so you can't even pull that together to be able to understand kind of what my ad on this radio channel, on this podcast actually drove. I think it's still a challenged channel. Lots of opportunity for it, but I also feel like, it's catching up, but I feel like I think the audio industry want audio to be seen as a performance channel because everyone talks about performance. But I think also it should kind of like almost accept and embrace that it's a really strong brand awareness channel and lean into that more because it 100%. Really is like, absolutely. It's one of the most uninterrupted,
an entertainment channel.
Yeah.
And if you...
It's the one thing I can't skip. Like I'm normally walking or driving while I'm listening to all these endless ads on the podcast I listen to. Like I can't skip them. And with radio, I can't skip them at all. Like with everything else, I will skip it where possible or I'll walk away or I'll turn away or tune out. It was in my ear. I'm not tuning out. So I think they need to really lean into the power of that in absence of better measurement.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like we should have this conversation with a marketer to really understand what it is that puts them off seeing it as a full funnel marketing opportunity. Because I think theoretically, you're absolutely right, Lindsay, but I just wonder how much of that is a perception, because I don't believe that of all the sort of audio tech solutions out there, they're not putting effort into making the measurement part of it a little more a little more detailed, a little more specific and improving it. They have to be, right? Because the other thing is as well, I no longer see audio as just an audio channel. It's also a video channel because what's one of the main drivers of audio? Yeah. It's podcasts. What are we doing right now? Filming our podcast. A mate of mine who works in post-production, Cheryl, said it's basically the chat show. It's the chat show reinvented.
It is. The chat show is having a massive renaissance.
That's it. So it's not just an audio channel anymore. But if you are a regular podcast listener, then you, depending on where you consume your podcast, you're getting it via audio and video.
But that then, if you're a marketer, that then, and any media buyers will agree.
Mind.
No, well, that then becomes a challenge of, well, what am I buying?
Exactly.
Am I buying audio?
Exactly.
Like, audience don't want to hear about it being, the podcast being viewed on video, because that's through YouTube.
So,
like, it's completely separate. And that's
exactly.
That's where it becomes a massive challenge. And then it's just like, who buys it?
That's right.
And how do we then bring across the two different departments? So we now have the AV team and the audio team, like, okay, the podcast performed this way, the video version of the podcast performed this way. We've got to bring those things together and attribute that correctly. Like, it's made everything a lot more complex from a marketer's perspective.
But that's part of the problem, right? And that's what I was going to get onto, is that, you know, budgets and the way that it's bought are still very siloed.
Yeah.
And I just think we are really moving towards a media environment where we can't afford to be so siloed anymore, because everything is potentially cross-channel. Mm. And that, in fact, is not just the way that we're consuming things, but it's also the way that AI and generative AI is driving us. And also, ultimately, it's obviously better for brands, and I'm going to scoop up publishers in that too, if they're being discovered across a whole range of different channels, that strengthens their brand. I understand there's some complexities from a tech perspective and also from a measurement and attribution perspective. That's exactly what we've got to get on top of, right? And I know that's not, you know, as easy as just making those statements.
Yeah.
But I feel like, you know, and we've been talking about the siloed approach to, you know, marketing budgets and what happens within agencies and various buying teams for as long as I've been running Exchange Wire. So it would have been going on for another 30 years prior to that, longer. But, you know, I think there is now a real impetus for everybody to change, because there's only a finite sort of amount of advertising and marketing dollars out there. We're not looking, you know, we're not looking at an industry. There's still a lot of growth, obviously, in the advertising industry, in the digital advertising industry, if it even needs to still be called that anymore. But we're not looking at the same growth trajectory that we were looking at the early days of programmatic, where it was considered a specific separate channel. It's not like that anymore. Actually, what marketers want to see is a change to their bottom line, and that's where investment is going to go. And therefore, I know that most agencies are wanting to drive their clients to look at that across the piece from a cross-channel perspective. So it's got to be possible to do it.
Yeah. I think IAB UK tracked ad spend for audio as grow a 10% growth in 2025. So there's growth there. It is massive.
Big.
There's definite growth there, and there's definitely opportunity for it. And I think that a really good example, touching on what you were saying, Rachel, is what we see from media owners and tech suppliers in the out-of-home space.
Mm.
Not the buying of out of home is siloed, but the buying of different channels is still quite siloed within agencies. Like, that's a blanket statement, so don't come at me. But there is still lots of silos when it comes to certainly these channels like audio, out of home, and AV more generally. But what we see from media owners and tech suppliers in the out of home space is they do not want to have an out of home conversation in isolation.
Yeah. Exactly.
On stage at ATS, it's just having chats with them. They want to talk about out of home in the context of omnichannel.
Yeah. Yep.
And I think audio need to kind of do the same thing and kind of go, yes, I'll talk about audio on this podcast, on stage, whatever, but I want to have the conversation as it pertains to omnichannel, because that's where it should sit and should exist. And all the out of home media owners, and we've, you know, this applies to London, it applies to Singapore, it applies to MENA as well. Any conversation I've had, certainly personally, about out of home has been like how it fits into everything else. I don't want people just kind of see this as another out of home conversation. Mm. I want them to see how it plays into the omnichannel role, because that's what they're trying to kind of get agencies and buyers to see. And audio needs to exist in that same space.
Yeah, agreed. Amazing. Sort it out. Audio industry.
Ask,
I don't even know who it
is. Yeah, yeah, I think that was a rich and fulfilling discussion around audio.
Rich and fulfilling.
Rich and fulfilling.
Yes,
absolutely. I'm going to go and listen to a podcast and buy whatever Peter Crouch tells me to buy. Now,
I'm interested to know what he advertises.
It's
actually
a holiday, isn't it? A travel.
He does a travel podcast.
I've heard it as well.
Yeah, they can answer your travel queries on their lovely couples podcast, Abby Clancy and Peter Crouch.
Mm. Do you listen to that?
No, but I'm advertised it every day.
Yes, same. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was a lovely episode. Thank you both so much for joining.
Thank you.
Lovely to
be part of it.
Thanks for having us.
And thank you to Kamel, Barney and Kiese for your questions. I'm going to pop their LinkedIns in the show notes, so if you want to pick up any of these issues with them, feel free. But thank you for contributing, and thank you all for listening. I'm watching.
I'm watching.
You've been listening to the Mad Tech Podcast, brought to you by Exchange Wire.